evening, good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this, welcome to the Film Realist Podcast, the film and TV podcast from a complete nobody that is hopefully for somebody. My name is Kyle Naranya, and welcome to episode 206, where on this week's episode of the podcast, I will be reviewing Masters of the Universe, the second attempt at adapting the He-Man world into a live-action feature film. As this is a feature film review, there will be a non-spoiler section as well as a spoiler section, and time codes for that will be listed in the description. Should you feel the need to hop around, I then will be responding to my favorite bits of movie news and then reacting to listener mail and question of the week responses. Let's return to Eternia with Masters of the Universe spoiler-free review.
Whoa.
It is quite heavy, so if you could just...
Oh, my God, yeah. Your loincloth is in my... Sorry.
Fine.
Now, because this is a Gen X property, at least the majority of the fandom, it's relevant as a millennial to give context for what I know about this universe and my fandom, if any, to said intellectual property. I am aware of the 80s-ness of this franchise. I would say it's not in the S tier or even A class of that era. You, of course, had Transformers, G.I. Joe, and then you've got like Thundercats and Voltron. I loved me some Voltron. And then, of course, that bled into my love of Power Rangers. But He-Man was not one of those shows that I really was invested in at all. If you're a longtime fan of the podcast, you know, actually, that the reason I love He-Man now is because of the two series brought to us by Kevin Smith, which I absolutely adored. What I love so much about what that did for the franchise was it took this character and it treated it seriously within a new show that gave you animation that you have in your memories. But then, of course, we go back and we look at that different era of not holding up remotely in terms of quality, specifically with anything really that came from Filmation in the 1980s. All of those shows, even some of the best ones, were toy commercials. He-Man, maybe more than any of them, maybe tied with Transformers. The world of Eternia and its characters were wild, and to treat them with respect and tell interesting stories was an absolute win from Masters of the Universe Revelation and Masters of the Universe Revolution. And it's unfortunate that I do not think we are going to be getting any more of that series, which is truly sad because the way that they were able to weave in a faithfulness of Eternia and tell the most interesting stories, I've not read a ton of the comics, of Eternia, and thoroughly made me invested and love these characters. So my approach to this franchise is through that realm. I've seen maybe the original pilot of the 80s show. So I'm going into this excited. If you've watched my trailer reactions, the most liked thing I've done on TikTok is my Masters of the Universe teaser trailer reaction, because this world and the people in it are so entertaining, but there's a mythos. There's a love of this franchise, and anything that Travis Knight has brought himself to, you can see all of that in those projects, whether it be Bumblebee, which gave us the most faithful adaptation of Generation 1 Transformers with that first, I believe it's about 15 minutes on Cybertron, and then really did sort of remake Transformers 1 in the best way possible. Now, on to Masters of the Universe, also known as He-Man and the Masters of the Universe in other places, but MOTU, or Masters of the Universe 2026, is unapologetically Masters of the Universe. That is a good and bad thing. The exploration in terms of the depth of the story is probably slightly elevated from the original cartoon, but not in a way that I've come to know and love from this universe. You are addressing so many things and having to tackle so many things because in this theatrical film, you are introducing likely an entirely new generation to the world of Eternia and the world of Masters of the Universe, which I saw somebody compare to Thor, and I push back on that idea because what was fascinating about Thor was we were shown Asgard, but then are told a very terrestrial story. We put the Asgardian God of Thunder in a small New Mexico town, and 90% of the movie is there. And what was so funny about watching this was we obviously see so much from Eternia in the trailers. This is not a spoiler. We know that Adam is sent away and then does return. And of course, to be He-Man, the most powerful man in the universe, he needs to be in Eternia with the Power Sword, given the power of Castle Grayskull, becoming that vessel. And this is not that. I had such an entertaining time with this movie. This is one of those instances where, and I've tried this to have this be the goal of a review with the Film Realist podcast over 200 episodes in now, is what is the goal of the film? Is it attempting to do something specific? Am I aware of the intended goal? And do I think the movie succeeded on what it's trying to do? And I wholeheartedly love that it does seem that Travis Knight accomplished his mission with Masters of the Universe. This is introducing a world that is treated respectfully. The tongue-in-cheek nature to the way that this story is told is through some of the naming conventions of characters, which is funny to enjoy how people were created, what the characters were within this world, but also attempt to do something that embraces everything earnest about the world of Eternia and the people that happen to inhabit it. We have some changes to the canon, which I will get into in full spoilers, but I had a blast with this. There is this aspect of making blockbuster films, specifically within the comic book genre, and there have been comics from He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, where since the dawn of the MCU, there is almost a side-eye aspect to some of this. We're going to be playing up the idea that we don't necessarily think this is all serious, maybe more often than audiences would necessarily appreciate. And He-Man has fun with the insanity presented in front of you, but not in a way where it feels like it's making fun of this thing itself. Transformers, ironically, as already stated, a universe in which Travis Knight has already played in, doesn't do that here with Masters of the Universe. Adam is true to the character that audiences know, specifically, I would say, much more in line with the 80s version. And Nicholas Galitz's scene really brings that earnest nature that I would say almost to some degree a doe-eyed, radically different version of what you might expect you would get from He-Man, which is obviously this immensely physically built, muscular hero that is the epitome of the 80s. It is a jacked man beating people up with a power sword. There's no subtlety to any of He-Man. And that works for what they're trying to do with this movie. This film is introducing its world, its main characters, why people love it, and enjoying what people like about it without feeling like it's taking the piss out of people who like it. You're not talking down to an audience. One of the worst aspects, specifically with Transformers, which is maybe the most adept conversation to have around this or any sort of comparison, is that it made fun of Transformers fans and lore. Yes, you love this thing. Isn't it so stupid? And to have the creative force and visionary behind a franchise you love treat it that way can feel very demeaning and offensive. If you love a specific 80s franchise, 90s franchise, 2000s franchise, you're excited to see what people are going to do with that thing you love. And for it to be taken out back and beat to death because that person doesn't take it seriously, you wind up getting something that is ultimately a mess. The world and the continuity of Transformers was an absolute disaster because it wasn't taken seriously. And that doesn't mean you have to treat it as if it's the Bible. You have to take the inspiration of what the faithful adaptation of that property would present in front of you. That is Masters of the Universe. It is silly. It is wild. It is over the top. There is quite literally, and you see this in the trailers for the film, Nicholas got into absolutely incredible shape for this movie. And the way in which they choose to hide it from the audience, as well as the other characters, is he is in baggy clothes, which feels perfectly in line with comments and criticisms to the original cartoon, which was it was cheaper to have the He-Man animated cartoon model just be the same as He-Man with a different costume on. There was no growth to that character from any physical attributes whatsoever. He just happened to be wearing less clothes. And the fact that Travis Knight understands the spectrum of which He-Man has permeated the pop culture zeitgeist is incredibly important. There is a sequence throughout this film that I was laughing because it appreciated, as a millennial, what my perspective and springboard moment into this franchise would be. I am not going to spoil it here, but I love that that's in here because when you have a franchise that has existed for as long as Masters of the Universe has, which is 44 years old, the original cartoon when it debuted, and getting this show now, which addresses its generational fandom by bringing in all those different elements and presenting a kind of film we haven't had since Dungeons and Dragons: Honor Among Thieves. I loved that movie, and it was unfortunate that regardless of it being a familiar world, with it being a fantasy film, what Goldstein and Daly were able to do with that was truly make something original in a world that people were aware of, that was so entertaining, so funny, but really about the characters that happened to be inhabiting the world presented in that film. Travis Knight and everybody involved in this does that. I think Camila Mendez does a great job at bringing a modern edge to Teela that does feel coherently connected to the Teela from the 80s show, but maybe more so from the newer Revelation and Revolution. You need these characters to have more meaningful relationships, or they just seem incredibly hollow. And thankfully, we don't get that from the movie. The dynamic between Man-at-Arms / Duncan and Teela is one that is wholeheartedly complex. Those things need to be there because, quite literally, if these characters feel like cardboard cutouts, like the way that some of the characters did in the animated version, the movie feels even less subtle and much more shallow. And the last thing you want to do when making a 2-hour film on an 80s kids cartoon toy commercial is feel that you have no substance to deliver whatsoever. There is a message and a meaningful attempt at a story in this, but unfortunately, the way in which it tries to weave all of those narratives together, it is a little muddy. And when you're delivering something that quite literally is a hero who wins through action, that doesn't really land, specifically in the way that they choose to have He-Man's whole point of view be / Adam through the movie. There is instances where it is fascinating the way in which they try to have a sort of moral perspective on Adam's existence as He-Man in the universe. And there's some dramatic changes that I didn't necessarily hate because of my perspective on the lore of He-Man. And again, 99% of this is from Revelation and Revolution. But overall, in terms of what to expect from something that is its own world that is so different from anything else, this is a world of Eternia that has science, that has magic. There are science fiction elements. There is a talking tiger, green tiger. There is a skull-faced man. There are spaceships. There are weapons. There are quite literally characters' arms that can change in an instant, and we get examples of that. It's funny to me, though, that in this, Duncan Man-at-Arms is very much in line with Idris Elba's other character in The Suicide Squad, where he played Bloodsport, which had a very similar aesthetic, I'd be curious if that was one of the reasons that Travis Knight wanted to cast Idris Elba. Most of the cast are lesser known actors, and that really does let the characters feel like they are coming to life in a three-dimensional human being in a way where you're not going, well, that's that person playing this. I'd say Nicholas is more of an unknown. If you watched Riverdale, you would know Camila. Idris Elba is obviously there. Jared Leto's Skeletor is so fun. That is a character that, ironically connected to last week's review with Nicolas Cage and Spidey or Spider-Noir, that character is at an 11. And there's something so refreshing to just hearing Jared Leto, you're not seeing the actor's face because, of course, it's a skull, playing with this whole movie, being menacing when needed to be, being the comedic bit at the end of jokes, and just an irrationally wild performance that perfectly fits in what you would expect from Skeletor. Alison Brie as Evil-Lyn, I think, was underused. That's a character that really grew on me as Revelation and Revolution went on, because we saw there was so much more to that character. And if this movie does end up winding up getting a sequel, I do think there's a lot more there to dive into. Alison Brie has shown in so many different projects, whether that be Glow or Community, that there is a range to what this actor is capable of doing. And I really hope that that character, who, yes, at a substantial part of the original animated series, is much more of a supporting character to Skeletor, does get her day in the sun to shine, because Evil-Lyn, with Alison Brie behind it, could really be the main antagonist of a film itself. Overall, the supporting characters of Ram-Man, Trap-Jaw, Fisto, Sorceress, Marina Baccarin perfectly fits the tone and what you would expect from the Sorceress, but she's not really in the movie enough for to really settle in on what she means to the universe and who she's connected to and really what that could lead to. She's just sort of there. I think if you are a He-Man fan, you will love this. If you do not have an entry point to Masters of the Universe, this is easily what you could have it being. I did see this with my wife, and Nalina did say she thinks, in her opinion, that this does skew a little bit older for child range. There's a couple of jokes that were definitely much more mature than I was expecting there to be in a Masters of the Universe movie, but I'm very happy that this delivered on all of my expectations. And the best thing that I can say after watching it is, while I do think it's unlikely, unfortunately, that we're going to get a sequel, because the worldwide gross for the box office was only $54.3 million, losing out to Scary Movie, I believe it's 6. I'm super bummed out about that, if I'm being totally honest, because I thought the trailers for that looked horrendous. And there's so many good original horror movies that if you're going to see something that is in the comedic genre, He-Man was much more entertaining. Although, yes, I'm completely aware in saying that I didn't see Scary Movie, and I quite frankly don't plan on it. But I had a great time with my 2 hours and 20 minutes of returning to Eternia after nearly 40 years. The first live-action film came out in 1987. So this is a world I like, and I'm glad we got to go back. So that will do it for my non-spoiler thoughts. Now let's get into the real nitty-gritty, because there's a lot to talk about with this. Spoilers ahead, you have been warned.
But taken away, his day is done. With the new dawn, Eternia shall witness my rise.
One of the most maybe controversial elements of Masters of the Universe Revelation was, one, they killed off He-Man, and two, part of the revelation was the reveal to specifically Teela, who was Adam's best friend, was that Adam himself was He-Man. This film chooses to completely remove the secret identity of who He-Man is. His name doesn't even come up until the very end, when he shows that all the nicknames for the characters, you know, so Fisto, Ram-Man, Trap-Jaw, Mechanek, Triclops, Spikor, Mossman, those are all sort of jokes in terms of what Adam remembered the characters as. So I found that interesting, because outside of that, everything else about Eternia and its world, its lore, its mythos, is treated quite seriously. So the balancing act of sort of feeling like you are in a silly Flash Gordon or Thor or Guardians of the Galaxy, and Nicholas has talked about his influence, and you can see some of that in here because Adam himself as the prince is sort of a buffoon in, as a child, he's smaller and picked on. And one of the parts that I wish the film managed to hit more effectively was an exploration of masculinity. Now, there is a generation that would absolutely hate for that to be an element of this movie, but when the iconography of He-Man and Masters of the Universe is this massive, super jacked man who is powerful and defeats others through, let's be totally honest, violence, that's not necessarily the worst idea for it. And some of the elements of this are really funny and are interesting in what the perspective is on delivering who Adam is versus He-Man. And there's a lot less separating them than there typically is, which is Adam on Earth works in human resources and conflict resolution because he's somebody who's supposed to believed to be this smaller, not strong person. And I already mentioned in non-spoilers how they try to hide that. This movie's budget at $170 to $200 million should have done something to really help sell that more than the film does in just putting Nicholas in baggy clothes. I'm disappointed that the choice wasn't made to truly separate Nicholas in terms of size as Adam and He-Man. I commend any actor who's willing to put in the physicality and work to become larger than life, quite literally through a body transformation. And Nicholas has been pretty public with the one that he did for this role. It was in Men's Health and a lot of the press that he did for it. Why they didn't, and I'm going to use an industry term, I guess, for this, used to skinny Steve him is must be either a budgetary or a almost fourth wall breaking choice. If it was the choice to do what I mentioned in non-spoilers, I understand why you would do that because, again, Travis Knight shows his understanding of where He-Man is throughout pop culture. There is a sequence of this movie when we hear, and I don't actually know the name of the song, so I'm going to have to look up the soundtrack really quickly, but I can say that the song has been stuck in my head for the entire weekend, which is, I believe it's Boys Don't Cry by The Cure. And that sequence was absolutely hilarious. If you are not a Masters of the Universe fan, no, it's not Boys Don't Cry. It's a different song. What is the song? It's What's Going On. I don't know the name of that. So I believe that's what it is. What's Going On, He-Man. Is that what the name of the song is? Or it's called something else. What's Up is the name of the song by Four Non-Blondes. So if you're familiar with that He-Man video, which it's crazy to me that it's 15 years old, there, the sequence in which Adam is saved from Teela after he's discovered the Sword of Power and Beastman shows up because the sword has sent out a signal and he doesn't turn into He-Man because he's on Earth when trying to summon the power of the sword, that song is playing throughout that entire sequence. And ignoring what likely introduced so many fans to He-Man would have been a mistake. And I commend Travis Knight in understanding the spectrum of Masters of the Universe. This is, by definition, a silly, stupid world. And not in a way where I go, this is dumb. There are so many rule-breaking characters where you can do such incredible things. And because this world is so entrenched in science fiction as well as magic, you can do pretty much anything. And in doing so, you allow more people to be entertained by the film on the big screen. This is a big screen movie. There are times where some of the cinematography, and I like the cinematography behind this, Fabian Wagner, he worked on Zack Snyder's Justice League and Venom the Last Dance, but ignoring that, the movie uses Adam's non-violence approach in an interesting way because he doesn't want to go into conflict. Growing up as somebody who was smaller and that would really be hammered home when Adam himself should be small, but they're trying to hide that fact from us, is an interesting entry point for Adam in ultimately becoming the hero of Eternia. We don't get a separation of personality. I would have described Prince Adam and He-Man as much more of a Clark Kent and Superman dynamic. And in choosing to remove his secret identity, you have this blend of a character who is trying to find himself while being powerful, and Adam figuring out who he is in this world, having returned to it, becoming this vessel for the power with the use of the sword, and doing something that fits much more in line with, at least what I've seen, some of the newer He-Man stuff. Gen X's, if this was in the original cartoon, I apologize, but I am unaware of that. If it is the case that the sword itself is not actually the vessel for the power of Castle Grayskull, it is actually Adam. He is a chosen one. He is a new person. Very in line with the Captain America thing, which is if you choose somebody who has always had power, they will abuse it. Where if you choose somebody who has grown up without it, they understand the responsibility of that power. Almost like with great power comes great responsibility, but that's a Marvel project, and of course you wouldn't be able to say that in an MGM Amazon film. There is a funny Amazon moment in this film, which of course is an Amazon truck doing something good, as opposed to what unfortunately the drivers are put through who have to handle all of those deliveries specifically through Prime. Overall, I shouldn't say overall, I'm not anywhere close to being done. So yeah, I really like the idea of exploring masculinity because it has been a constant conversation probably over the last decade. And where Adam fits in that conversation, you have baby boomers. How old is Idris Elba? I should probably look that up. He's 53. I would guess that's a late Gen X. When is he born? 1972 Gen X. When are you born? What is the year typically for that? What is a Gen X? 1970. So yeah, he would be a Gen X. And their idea of masculinity and not talking about their feelings and having those conversations be a stretch for them and their growth. He-Man is only He-Man because of a failure of Duncan in the beginning of the film. We see the king and Mad-at-Arms really being like, well, you're a man, you need to be strong and you need to protect us. And Duncan's failure brings him closer to Teela and the understanding that people are going to try, and that doesn't necessarily mean you are going to be successful all of the time. There is an attempt here to have a much grander story, but because it is also a He-Man movie, there's only so much time in really diving into all of those elements with any thorough exploration. And that's okay. You don't need the film to be this massive, serious drama. That won't work in the world of Eternia. Masters of the Universe, at the end of the day, is a lot of really cool people fighting that look whole so succinctly different from everybody. And you get all of that in this. We get a great rivalry between Trapjaw and Man-at-Arms, which I really liked. Man-at-Arms is, as I said in On Spoilers, very much Bloodsport. All of the tech that he's capable of, Teela is very competent fighter. And we get a bunch of the supporting characters that are so specific in what they're capable of, they're definitely going to be a toy, which obviously they were. I enjoyed myself with this film. The soundtrack by Daniel Pemberton is amazing. Now, he's worked on Project Hail Mary, the Spider-Verse films. This guy's absolutely incredible in what he's able to bring. And it has that flair of the 80s without feeling like it is derivative of anything else. This movie is Masters of the Universe through and through and through and through. I loved it because it is what He-Man and Masters of the Universe is. We get an opportunity to learn about Adam and see his progression as the hero of Eternia, which is, as you would coming into power that is unknown to him, doubting himself, not really understanding how he can be the protector that people believe him to be, trying to approach it through the human resources model that he has learned on Earth, bringing people together, being that hero, quite literally learning this through exposition, that he is the chosen one and not just you happen to be holding the weapon that allows you to have the power. That was something that did throw me for a loop because in the more recent versions of this universe, Skeletor as well as Evil-Lyn were able to summon the power of Castle Grayskull because they did have possession of the sword. So if that is the canon of the live action films, that would lead me to believe we're not going to see those roided out versions of those two characters because those twists were really cool. Seeing Adam die wasn't something I thought was going to happen in this movie at all, because this is, of course, a He-Man movie, and when He-Man dies, a lot of keyboard warriors get really mad. But the movie gives you a expanded cast and doesn't just go, this is the He-Man, 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 He-Man. You need an ensemble to be interesting and to have a fun back and forth, or the movie at the end of the day is just not fun to watch. You can have stories with small casts, and this movie really does do that for the most part. There's a handful of characters we really get to focus on. The production design is awesome. I'm so glad that they built so many of these sets or went to real locations, because it makes this world of Eternia feel tangible. It doesn't just feel like a volumetric set, although there are some background replacements that I didn't necessarily love, but budgets are going to be what they are. I don't think we're going to be getting a sequel, unfortunately, unless this has an absolutely incredible second weekend. It is frustrating to a fan of fantasy and science fiction that this is a much more original world that people aren't bored of, like so many other franchises. I'm going through my June and July calendars, and there's a lot of stuff that is just sequels, which is not always a bad thing, but it can burn you out sometimes if there's nothing new to say with those worlds. We've only had two He-Man / Masters of the Universe films, and while the 1987 film is a very much more so a mess, it does have Frank Langella as an absolutely incredible Skeletor. The cast in this understood the assignment. The director in this understood the assignment. And they delivered a great first entry into this new version of the universe. And the fact that it ends on a post-credit scene for Princess Adora, aka She-Ra, that may never have payoff is truly disappointing. As a fan of this world, I am a fan. Now, I may not have been born in the 80s, but I guess I'm one at heart. That'll do it for my spoiler review of Masters of the Universe. I believe it had the power! And now it's time to move on to my favorite movie news of the week.
Tonight at 11.
Doom!
We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves, you might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
All right, here is the movie news that I have written up for this week. So it's not a ton, but it's enough that I'm looking forward to talking about, which is, Jermaine, I hope you're listening to this, because the first thing is some DCU Studios stuff. We got our first official look at the Lex Luthor suit as they started shooting outside in a real street. I think they're in Atlanta. And he is also fighting Superman, as well as we do know now, James Gunn revealed that the film has a 2-year real-time time jump set after Superman in 2025. We know Man of Tomorrow will be 2 years later because it is coming out, of course, in July of 2027. What's awesome about this is all of the announcements for Man of Tomorrow were three different comic book artists showing us their interpretation of the Lex Luthor suit. The Lex suit is something that I was very first introduced to with Superman, Batman, Public Enemies, which of course had Lex Luthor taking kryptonite-laced steroids to make himself stronger. I still do think that could be a part of this story, because last time we saw Lex Luthor in Peacemaker Season 2, he had a limp after being absolutely assaulted by Krypto at the end of Superman. So we have some vague understanding that these characters are going to be working together, when, of course, fighting off Brainiac. We know that Supergirl is also going to be in Man of Tomorrow, as well as some other potential Justice League members, as Aaron Pierre and a bunch of other people. But the fact that we see these characters in conflict, Superman and Lex Luthor, isn't super shocking, pun intended, because, of course, I've said, of course, way too many times in this episode, and I'm realizing that as I'm speaking. These characters are only going to be working together because of a threat that is global for the entire world itself. They're going to fight against them. Would it be shocking that Brainiac and Lex Luthor team up? No, it has happened in a wide variety of interpretations, maybe most famously for millennials in Justice League Unlimited, at the end of the second season of that show, where they teamed up together, leading to an amazing Flash moment that, if you're unaware of it, check it out. It's awesome. Absolutely cool to see those two characters work together. And Lex Luthor, being the conniving backstabber that he is, maybe he makes an alliance with Brainiac to kill off Superman. I'm not assuming this stuff's going to happen. I just am sort of predicting based on what I know of those characters. It's cool to see that they're shooting in real streets. There have been some minor adjustments to the Superman costume, which is not shocking. The first iteration, if it's not perfect, usually you sort of fine tune it. There were minor changes to Tobey Maguire's suit between Spider-Man 1 and Spider-Man 2. Something I would hope we get in the DCU, if there's time, is don't change suits too much. I understand with marketing and toys, merchandise of all varieties, that you want something to help separate it within the sequels. But you know what would also be really cool? Just have an iconic look that stays. That would be great. We might see what the new The Batman Part 2 suit looks like soon, because that will be entering production in not that long from now. But I would prefer, the suit's great. Batman sort of does modify his stuff, but Superman, his suit shouldn't change that much. Unless it's, of course, destroyed and he dies, and then you need a black suit, because the black suit's really cool. I don't really have anything else to say about the Superman news. The next piece is something that I've addressed in the world of this franchise, which is John Wick's Kane spinoff has entered production, and we now know that it's going to be adding Mason Thames, who was the live-action Hiccup in How to Train Your Dragon, which wasn't one of the live-action adaptations that I loved. I do think Mason brought a lot of entertainment to a young, or not a young, but a live-action Hiccup. John Wick is a world that only elevated over time. Of course, so many people love that first film. Two's kind of a hit and miss, but 3 and 4 are some of the best action movies ever made, and the conclusion of that story, in my opinion, should be maintained. If you're going to keep going back to this world and this universe and this film franchise, just make spinoffs. Ballerina, great idea to bring Keanu back because of when it fit in the timeline, but Donnie Yen's Kane was a great character, and his world itself could be it would be so different and just as cool if we're maybe seeing the Hong Kong part, or the China part, or the Japanese or Thailand part of the John Wick world. Anytime John Wick traveled, that was some of the most interesting stuff, as opposed to it just being the Continental in New York. They had a James Bond element where you really felt that this was a lived-in space, that there was all these relationships from past adventures. Let's keep doing that with other characters. We don't need to quite literally dig John Wick out of the grave. Please don't do that. And a little bit of Marvel news. Marvel Secret Wars is now officially, I guess, technically in pre-production. We have a statement from the Russos that says, I will say this, the stories that we're focused on are now complete. Doomsday and Secret Wars speak with one another as two films, and they form a complete expression. Whether or not we collaborate with Marvel beyond this point is certainly a possibility, but right now the vision and the narrative vision is just Secret Wars. What I find so funny about that is, if you remember when they were doing press for Infinity War and Endgame, which initially was Infinity War Part 1 and Infinity War Part 2, there was this idea being put out by Marvel that they were two different films, yet they weren't at the same time. I would argue that they are two different films just in the way that they explore the Marvel characters and they serve different purposes in the universe. Yes, it is to some degree a cliffhanger, but what works so well about Infinity War was it is really Thanos' story, and he has come to a resolution at the end of it, sitting in his little farm in that space planet. I mean, all planets are in space, but that far-off planet. He achieved his goal. Yes, there's a lot of characters that were killed off, and we are leading into them in Endgame, but that movie is about the original Avengers and some additions saving the world. So those movies do serve different functions, and the way that they're talking about Secret Wars leads me to believe it's going to be exactly the same. That's not a new idea. I'm sure there's a ton of people that have had similar thoughts, But Doomsday and Secret Wars are going to serve different purposes. Doomsday should feel like the conclusion of the multiverse saga to some degree, whether that be its purpose is to bring all the characters together to then fight, I don't know, the Beyonder in Secret Wars. I'm not sure, because Doomsday is functioning differently than Infinity War, which did, yes, bring the Guardians into the world and other characters who hadn't met each other before. Spider-Man, of course, had met Tony, but then he went to space with some of the Guardians. Most people listening to this probably did see Infinity War. But Doomsday is bringing all the characters together, because we haven't seen that yet. The multiversal saga has not truly been an exploration of the multiverse. It's been a multi-mess. Doomsday's a different kind of thing. I think Doomsday, more than Infinity War, will feel like a part one. The likelihood of Robert Downey Jr. being killed off as Dr. Doom, I think, is much more likely if we have a different villain for Secret Wars. But the newer version of Secret Wars did have Dr. Doom being much more connected to that story. So I don't know, but I am excited for what we are going to be getting at the end of December from Avengers Doomsday. But before we do get that, there is Spider-Man Brand New Day, which I am just as excited about, because we finally get what we expected from a Spider-Man film, but that's maybe only from millennials who grew up on the Tobey and Andrew Garfield films. That will do it for news. Now let's get to listener mail and question of the week responses.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I really need to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, what lesser-known 80s cartoon would you like to see as a film? We got so many answers on TikTok. I went through and I compiled all of the top answers, because if I read them all, you'd still be listening to that portion of the podcast probably on Tuesday. Dylan writes in, screw it, let's do Thundercats. Or I guess Captain Planet. That's about it. I don't think really any more should get made for that. Scotty Cameron writes in, it's MASC, Mobile Armored Strike Command. It's basically the love child between G.I. Joe and Transformers, a counter-terrorist team like G.I. Joe pilots that vehicles transform into other vehicles, while the new MASC comic coming out that's part of the Robert Kirkman Energon universe. A movie would be cool, since G.I. Joe was teased in Transformers Rise of the Beasts. I'd take that as an opportunity to bring in Skybound in for Energon movie universe, so we can get two good Transformers movies and a good G.I. Joe movie. Now, Scotty, Transformers has had multiple movies, and you know what, Scotty? I'm going to push back a little bit on this, because Robert Kirkman was throwing a lot of shade about DC and Marvel, and I'm sorry, that's really easy to say when most of your stuff is just influenced by all of those things. I'm sorry, Batman is one of the best comic book characters of all time, and I'm gonna push back on that. So a compilation of all of the answers we got on TikTok, over 200, so many, and then there were some similar answers from on YouTube as well. So here are those answers. Johnny Quest answered a bunch. Although, was there not a Johnny Quest movie? Or maybe I'm making that up in my head. I know there have been a lot of different series. No, it's been in development for years. Thundercats. It's funny to me that Thundercats hasn't really gotten a chance for this. I know, obviously, the Cats film would make this in budgetary completely irresponsible. But the 2011 Thundercats show functioned for myself in the exact same way that Transformers, not Transformers, thank you for that, Scotty, that's your fault, Masters of Universe Revelation did, which it really introduced me to that lore and the world, and when treating it with almost a Shakespearean level of respect, it would be awesome, and Lionel's such a great character. It's too bad that that show came out in 2011, really before streaming hit, because Voltron Legendary Defender, which is getting a movie, so Voltron was removed from a possibility, is a great version of that show, and that's, again, the best version of that story. MASC was brought up a lot. Shout out to Rob Keyes, who I know would have loved this suggestion, Dino Riders. It's where the Jurassic World films should have gone and never did. Come on, Universal, what are you doing? What kind of rebirth was that? Gummy Bears? Honestly, just for the theme song alone, that would be worth watching. The Raccoons? I'd watch the hell out of that. And then what is, you know, it's so funny when you look at all these things and it was, I blame Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for this, which is, it's just a bunch of animals doing weird things they shouldn't be doing. Biker Mice from Mars. Could you, I would just take that. It doesn't even need to be live action. Animated would be absolutely sick. I would watch the hell out of that. Then we have Thundar the Barbarian, which I believe was slightly connected to He-Man or just very similar. But when did that come out? 1980. So technically it was before. But there's something about all those shows in that era just being vaguely similar and nobody was suing each other then. And our last example, which, my God, I would just absolutely gobble up. Samurai Pizza Cat. Who do you call when you want some pepperoni? The Samurai Pizza Cats. Those characters are nuts. That theme song is such an earworm. It would get stuck in my head every single day of the week. And now, for all the people who suggested that answer, thank you, because now that is going to be stuck in my head for the rest of the week. I'm so grateful to all the people who watched the question of the week on whatever social media platform, whether that be YouTube, TikTok, Instagram. It really means a lot to me that just simply me asking a question about what's coming up for the podcast gets so many interactions, because it means people are interested in what's going to be on the podcast. So if you responded to that TikTok or that YouTube short or reel, whatever, if you responded or if you commented on that vertical reel, please come check out the podcast and comment on YouTube or Spotify, hey, that was me, because it would be great to see the sort of cross-pollination from the two different parts of the Film Realist podcast. Now, on to next week's question of the week, which is inspired by Disclosure Day, which is the next film from Steven Spielberg. So it is the simplest question, because believe it or not, this is the very first Steven Spielberg review that is going to be on the podcast. What is your favorite Steven Spielberg film? To let me know, you can comment below. I said this already, but I'll say it again on YouTube and Spotify. You can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com, or you can add the hashtag QOTW and just make sure to at the Film Realist on whatever social media platform you choose to use. Film Realist is on them all. If you are watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe. It helps the podcast grow and reach more people in their algorithm. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Kyle Naranya, and I will see you next time.